I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready to carry the show again on my shoulders.
Somebody's got to.
Ooh, I got some good stuff in here. I'm reading it right now, and it's good stuff.
I'm going to have to take your word for it until I hear it.
So don't fuck around with interjecting when you shouldn't be interjecting. And if you do interject, don't get any on me. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, sometimes known by his poor name as Robert Bumtoucher, or as... I'm not doing it again. Or as done, as said in Paris and in France, Robert Bumtoucher.
No, they call it the derriere.
Well, thanks for ruining my joke. You may remember Rob from his movies in the 1980s, where he played the reoccurring character of the pizza guy in many, many adult films, and was so popular that character was actually crossed over into an episode of Matlock. Do you remember that?
Don't make me interject.
Where you played the pizza guy on Matlock? You remember that? Okay.
Oh,
we are coming to you from a now heated studio somewhere. I'm sorry. I'm still thinking of you on that episode of Matlock. You were good. In a heated studio somewhere outside the big city, but in a small city. Riddle me this. That was too funny. You know, sometimes I should make the intro too
funny.
Yeah,
you got to reel it in.
Reel it in, man.
Save that stuff for middle.
The middle. On today's Robert Bumtoucher. on today's show, we'll be paying tribute to the life of Jimmy Buffett, or as my little nieces and nephews call him, Buffet.
Buffet, that's what I call him.
Yeah. You're just like my little nieces and nephews. Who unfortunately recently, not my nieces and nephews, but Jimmy Buffett recently passed away. And we will be reviewing his debut album from 1970, Down to Earth, which I know will be a controversial choice for all the parrot heads out there. But there is a method to my madness, as I will explain later. Da, 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 da. Now, speaking of parrot heads, I'm making myself laugh with my own script. Now, speaking of parrot heads, Rob, how was your week? And was it any different than 2 days ago when we last taped?
My week was filled with bustle and hustle.
Your brother is in town, by the way.
My brother is in town. And my brother will be leaving town tomorrow.
May I ask why your brother is leaving so quickly?
I don't know. This afternoon he was going to stay a couple days. But then he came to where I live. And he talked to the lady I live with. And then he said, I think I'm going home tomorrow. Wow. Oh. What could the lady have said to have driven him away so quickly?
So surprising. Okay. You know, your stories are getting much better because you're basing them on fact instead of just saying, blah, you don't like stuff like that, blah, blah, blah. You know?
No, my stories are getting better because every now and then things actually happen.
Yeah. And sometimes they don't.
Yeah. A whole lot of weeks, they don't.
No, it's boring.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Ooh.
Okay. Odds and ends. Lost time is not found again. Now, we just... See, sometimes you don't know why I'm laughing, and it's because Rob does something funny while I'm talking. Just so you know that I'm not laughing because, oh, that's real funny. Lost time was not found again. He only said that 5,000 times. No, Rob does something funny while I'm talking, which is very unprofessional, but that's why I laugh.
He said lost time is not found again, and I looked for lost time.
Now, we just want to remind you that next week, Rob...
Me?
Yes.
Ooh.
Next week is what?
Next week is...
Ho, ho, ho. Hey, boys and girls.
The Easter.
Yes, it's our annual Christmas episode, which is always full of fun and gaiety. Rob will be supplying the gaiety.
And I get to drink on that show too, so enjoy.
Yeah, as always, I will be bringing the eggnog. And
lots of eggnog, and I'll be adding beer to it.
This is our fifth annual, I'm not sure, I don't count them. I think it's our fifth annual Christmas show.
I think so. We remember all the Christmas albums we've done. And
That's how I always do it, but now they're starting to get out of hand. So it is almost always our most popular episode every year. Almost, I say. But it is definitely one of the most popular episodes, without a doubt. Is our Christmas episode. It's always in the top three for every year. It will be That's the chicken.
The chicken.
Now, like the other podcasts, like the gardening channel.
Yeah, which all our listeners are familiar
yes.
with.
Yes. You usually would edit that out, but you know what? It adds ambience to the show. And that adds... It will also, next week will also be the last, as usual, the last episode of the year. Yeah. It will be our 38th episode this year for all of you counting at home, which if you are, I think you may need some help. Because there's no reason to count the shows. It just shows.
You're being silly.
Not you, but the people are counting.
Yeah.
Not me.
Not you. I want to make sure I didn't offend you with that statement.
I'd like for the show next week, not do it on the air, but I'd like to find out what the average is of the shows we do, because at first we didn't take any weeks off, and then we found out that the show was draining us of all of our energy.
Oh, yeah. When you don't get a break, you need a week off.
So I'd like to see what the average is. I bet you it is around, I think we did a lot more shows than usual this year, actually. I think it's probably around 35 shows a year. That's a lot of shows. When you do it year after year, people, that's a lot of shows that we dedicate to you. No, I was going to say something, but I didn't. Because I love them. I mean, sometimes I don't, but I love our audience.
I love our audience.
Sometimes I don't, but I love our but I love our audience. So remember, tune in next week. There'll be so much fun. People might even pee your pants. So don't listen with friends, because that's embarrassing.
No.
You're listening. You pee your pants. What do you say?
You say, too much eggnog. That's what I always do.
Oh, you do that quite often with friends around, eh?
Oh, they can all tell you about Uncle Rob.
Also on Odds and Ends, we made a mistake on last week's episode. Do you remember last week's episode, Rob?
It was the one we did last week, 2 days ago.
2 days ago, yes. 2 days ago, that's right. Very good, Rob. Usually you're very slow on things like that, but that's a good one.
Usually I'm not paying attention.
It seems on last week's episode, Rob said that he liked the Gary Wright's Dreamweaver album. And we apologize for that. I think he was just pulling our leg on that one, weren't you, Rob?
Fools.
I'm just joking. He liked it, and I still don't understand. I don't think we ever will quite understand, except all you other Gary Wright fans who like the Dreamweaver album like he does. I don't understand you people either.
I like the music.
Did you say, I like the music?
I like the music. I like some other stuff about it.
You are so racist to go against the Italian people like that with your very cheap and sundry...
That was like a stage accent. A stage Italian accent.
if it was like you were auditioning for The Godfather, that's what you would do.
Auditioning for The Godfather?
And you said, I like it, The Godfather. That's what you do. That's okay. The only Italian accent.
Fantastic. I got the part for a movie that was made 30 years ago, 50 years ago.
I'm just
70
saying,
years ago.
That's the voice you would use if you were auditioning for The Godfather, is what I said. Not okay. That you were, yeah, and you would go, I like it, The Godfather.
Well, it's now a useless voice to have. All the auditions are over.
I like it. I got it.
So we're gonna go with James Cullen.
So the only accent you would do would be for Laika, and everything else would just be you talking.
Yeah, just me talking. Okay. Little bits here and there. Life is a salad bar,
as they say.
It's a bad salad.
Anyway.
Odds and ends.
Yeah, what we should do for our 200th episode. No, odds and ends is over. Odds and ends is freaking over. Oh. But we should find out, and we can't find out because I'd have to listen to every single episode. But for our 200th episode, which is by Christmas, will only be 5 episodes away.
Yeah.
We should find out how many times I said anyway because you disturbed the show so much.
I'm going to guess an average of 3 times per show for 200 shows. I'm going to guess 600.
Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot of you fucking up and me trying to move on. Okay.
It's fun. That's what makes the show what it is.
So today we have part 2 of our look at Rolling Stone's recent poll of the 250 greatest guitarists of all time. And today we are looking at their top 50 list of guitarists. We're going down from 50, not exactly 50, but around 50 to 1.
Ooh,
scare ya?
We'll find out who number 1 is.
I made it sound very heavy. And not heavy like it's hard to lift, but heavy as in that's heavy, man.
Oh, like weighty in the mind.
Weighty in the mind. Like Grateful Dead music. Anyways, so let's start off with number 47. We don't have time to go through everyone. People.
We're just going to bring out some notable.
Oh,
ones.
These people. You know, I know there are loving listeners, but sometimes, Rob, they piss me off.
They're impossible to please.
I love them, though.
Almost always.
Almost always when I'm on the air. The Edge at number 47, of course, of U2. And this shows you, I agree with this. And I'll tell you why, because this shows you this is not about technical expertise of a guitar solo or doing this and that. It's about guitar sounds. It's about what you do with a guitar. Nobody sounded like The Edge when he came out.
He came up with a kind of an Edge style.
He did. Very, very nice. Very nice. And he did. If you were there at the time when, you know, I Will Follow came out and stuff like that, you will realize that one of the things that was so attractive about U2 was this guitar sound that nobody had really heard before. And he seemed to be the master of almost making the guitar sound unlike anybody else playing the guitar. And with his chords and with mainly with his lines that he would make up for the beginning and ends of songs. And yes, that's why it's hard to pick. Well, it's hard to pick any list because they're stupid anyways. But it's hard to pick a greatest guitarist because you're picking like people who are great on rhythm guitar. People who are great on
lead.
Becoming with licks that
slide
are harmonious.
Guitar.
Slide guitar, lead guitar solos, just the guitar sound itself. Various variables that are, and then how do you rate that this person, because of his like The Edge, is better than this person who does fluid guitar solos all the time, like a B.B. King, you know, who doesn't even play rhythm guitar when he plays, he just plays solos. How can you rate these people? You can't. And I know that you can, but don't ever take it as the Bible. Just take it as a guideline and then listen to some of the things, the guitar players that sound interesting to you, and then make your own list. We say this over and over again, but it's so important because lists are so, they're kind of needed if you're learning about music and or anything. If you're learning about movies, lists help you to watch the movies and then make your own list. But it's so important not to think that just because Rolling Stone has a list, that's the be-all, end-all.
No, the nice thing about the list is it's basically a lump of 250 really good guitar players here. And if you just abandon the rankings, it's actually kind of cool.
That's
exactly the rankings.
That's actually exactly the point we're trying to make.
We've all got to be equal and democratic.
Is that if we had the 250 greatest guitarists of all time and just maybe listed them alphabetically, I would have no problems with that. But to say the Edge is better than so forth and B.B. King or whatever, they're playing two totally different. They might as well be playing two different instruments because they play it so differently.
That's what I discovered years ago in the top 10 list in some of the guitar magazines. Like, you know, at first I kind of, okay, this guy's better than this guy.
Yeah.
But then I realized there is no best.
No,
there is. You get as fast technically as you're going to get, and then you just get different.
And you know what? You're right. Because when you're a kid, you don't have the maturity as you do.
Yes.
And you do base it on these, oh my God, well, they have it in a magazine. It must be this guy's better than this guy. And then you grow up a little bit, you listen to more music, and you realize you can't judge art. You can't judge this guy is better or this album is better than this album.
It can only be a personal choice.
It can only be a personal choice. And speaking of that, right below that, number 46, is I can say that with much confidence, one of our favorite guitarists of all time, Frank Zappa.
Oh, yeah.
Who is extremely different in his guitar playing. How can you base Frank Zappa's brilliant guitar playing, which is totally out there, but still rhythmic and commercial, to anybody else? I've never heard a guitar player play like Frank Zappa.
I always grew up thinking of Frank Zappa as like a satirical songwriter. Mm-hmm. And every now and then I'd get an album and I'd listen to it and I'd stop every now and then like, fuck, this guy's good on guitar. Wow.
That's the aggravating part, is that he could write music for orchestra. Mm-hmm. He could do satirical funny songs. He could do, actually once in a while, get in the top 40 with his songs. Do so many things, and then on top of that, oh, by the way, I'm a killer guitar player. It's like, please.
I'm glad he was on this list, because a lot of other lists wouldn't include him. He's fantastic.
Oh, he is fantastic. And maybe 30 years ago he wouldn't have been on this list, but nowadays he is considered, because of his different approach, one of the best guitarists of all time. And again, he is in my top 20 of all time, if not top 10. I always like to point that out because, you know, do we like this guy? But we don't, like, you can have a top 10, but even then I don't judge. Well, sometimes I say this guitarist affects me more than anybody when I hear it. So he's my favorite guitarist.
And that's what makes it personal?
Yes, that's what makes it personal. But are these guitarists better? There's no way to judge when they're so different and they have different styles. And
this is a list for children.
This is a list for children. Sorry, I got carried away there.
This is a list for children.
See, now we're getting to really good guitar players. We want to talk all the time about Steve Cropper, of course, from the Booker T and the MGs, and everybody knows him from Soul Man, where John Belushi goes out, play Steve!
Always the Blues Brothers.
One of the best guitarists of all time. Did the Chicken Scratch guitar. Definitely in the top 50, as far as I'm concerned. And then, see, now we got one coming up that Rob may disagree with, and
that guy's a hack.
And in a way, I kind of too. Johnny Ramone never played guitar solos, but was an unbelievable rhythm guitar player. Should he be in the top 50? I don't know. He should definitely be in the top 250 guitarists of all time. That's where the rating is just, I know we're talking about it almost every guitarist we talk about, but it's, I can't see how people can get together and say, this is going to be our list, and we're going to put Johnny Ramone at 44, and he's better than Frank Zappa.
This list is, it's dividing people.
It divides me into two halves. No, I actually love Johnny Ramone's guitar playing. As a rhythm guitar player, he almost never makes mistakes. And they're very simple, though. Like, they're very three-chord, four-chord music, but he still never makes mistakes. And that's, you know, he created a whole generation of guitarists with your do-it-yourself system of playing. As we go down, Vernon Reid of Living Colour. Yeah, he's good. I don't know much of it. Cult of Personality. Remember that song? Cult of Personality.
Yeah,
from Living Colour. Yeah.
That's on my Grand Theft Auto game, so yeah.
Oh, one of my favorites, Bo Diddley at number 41. Of course, everybody knows the Bo Diddley beat, which is the shaving a haircut, two bits. I always got to do that when we play. Because I can extend it to 12 minutes, and I just love it because it even though it's only like five chords, dun, 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 yeah. You could actually with dynamics stretch that out, and it can mean so much. And for that alone, Bo Diddley is for me being a rhythm guitar player is so important. And definitely,
he invented his own beat.
That
is the Bo Diddley beat.
Yeah.
Well, that guy, I hate him.
Oh, and the young brothers, Angus and Malcolm.
Okay,
you can't dismiss. How can you come up with AC/DC? All those riffs. Like, I have a hard time when I'm writing a real rock song to come up with one riff. How can you come up with like 50? Over your career that are just killer. Like it reminds me of the which I would assume will be on this list a little bit later on, Tony Iommi. Like the same thing. How do they come up with these licks?
I've heard that's every what album says about him is he just can come up with incredible stuff.
And the one thing he said, I remember he said when Black Sabbath were touring a lot and doing a lot of coke in kind of that Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, Sabotage period. And he said, like, it's only because I was so tired and I was doing a lot of coke that I could not come up with the licks that I wanted to. If I can come up with licks, I'm concentrated. I can do it. And I believe him. Yes, I don't think that's boasting. I actually think he can.
You know, some of the other albums came out. The Ronnie James Dio albums, I absolutely love.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. I know. I believe him when he says, hey, if I'm clean and sober and my mind is straight, I can come up with the licks. Just give me some time alone. And it's like, well, then give me a few.
See, I'm the opposite.
And the same thing for Angus and Malcolm Young. I mean, holy smokes. Just coming up with things just in the first five years of AC/DC with Bon Scott alone. They came up with a whole lifetime worth of riffs, let alone after Bon Scott died and Brian Johnson came in to sing. I mean, holy smokes. One of my favorite guitarists at 37, I don't know. I modeled a lot of the guitar player angst on Pete Townsend. He was really, along with Jimmy Page, my first real guitar hero. Because I love rhythm guitar and I love the... And I think he's the best rhythm guitar player ever. I think he's the best because he can go from rhythm, just like Jimmy Page, from rhythm to a lead guitar and back. And plus his chording is very important. If you see The Who at Woodstock or anything around that time, about 1969, 70, he's just playing chords and the solos are important. But you can tell that the chords are like conveying the emotion for him. And it says right here in Rolling Stone, Pete Townsend didn't invent power chords, but his guitar pairs it down to just two notes, the root and the fifth. And the way that he can show how big that sound is, that's very accurate. That's what it did to me. It showed me how big a rhythm guitar sound could be in a band, in a three-piece band musically. I think it changed the way I thought it, that, you know what? The rhythm isn't just the guy who holds down the beat. The rhythm can be all-encompassing. And then you add a little bit of lead in there. You know what I mean?
I like his lead playing.
Well, and his lead playing. I think
they don't
that,
talk about his lead playing.
Again, here's a guy that... writes some of the greatest songs in the history of music, let alone rock and roll, is a brilliant live performer, one of the best live performers ever. As a great singer, as far as I'm concerned, he started off as a weak singer, but became a very commanding singer in his own right with his voice.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't like his voice.
He didn't like his voice at the beginning, and very rarely used it, only when, you know, Roger would say, no, your voice is good for this. And then he started releasing his solo albums, and his voice gained strength and authority and confidence, and I think he became a great singer. And then on top of all of that, just like with Frank Zappa, oh yeah, he plays one of the best guitars, you know, he's one of the best guitarists ever. So, like, sometimes you're just, it's just like a Paul McCartney, you know, he's like a genius. Why does he have to be a genius at everything? Why does the one instrument that they kind of relegated him to when Stuart Sutcliffe quit the Beatles, and he said, he was the only guy that would say, okay, I'll play the bass. And then he becomes one of the best bass players ever. It's like, well, that's not right.
Part of that is talent. A part of it is just the hard work you put into it. I mean, they started playing 5 years before they started recording, and they played hard.
It's still not fair. I heard that the other day. I heard something on the radio. Just as I was getting out of my car, I had just parked it in front of my place. And all I could hear was the bass as I was hearing the last 10 seconds of the song. Stunning. It was. And I know George Harrison said, it's always funny. He said, you know what, Paul, you're playing way too much for this simple love song. And he just said, trust me. Trust me. And, of course, they weren't getting along very well at that point. But still, George Harrison knew enough to trust him and say, okay, well, let's see how it works out. And, of course, he can't take away from it because... That's pretty brilliant, Paul.
That bass line always goes through my head when I'm singing the song.
I know. He does that all the time. He does not just play along with the song. He makes up his own part for everything. And you're talking over 200 Beatles songs, let alone his solo career. We're not even supposed to be talking about Paul McCartney here.
He's not on the list.
This is one of the most controversial ones we're going to get. I don't know if we're going to finish today. We might have to... do this again in the new year because we're only at number 35. But there's a reason that Eric Clapton is at 35, and it's not for his guitar playing. The controversy, I know this for a fact. I don't have to ask anybody. I don't have to call Rolling Stone and talk to them. I know that he's at 35 because of his controversial stance on COVID, that it's all bullshit, and that and his comments that vaccines are evil, and his very much of his non scientific views have put him from number two, which is everybody always puts him at number two as the second greatest guitarist of all time, to number 35. This is 100% political. And as much as I disagree with Eric Clapton, and I've never really liked him as a person.
Musically, how would you rank him?
Exactly. Even though I disagree with him on so much in his personal life.
No, keep going.
In his personal life, I can separate that and say, hey, when I hear him play guitar, I don't hear too many I don't hear too many better players. Only Hendrix and Beck and Page are in that category of people who just play the solos. So to put him at 35 is definitely, I don't like your views. Rolling Stone is saying, I don't like your views, Eric, so we're going to sting you a little bit, okay? you're not number two or three anymore. You're number 35.
Another shameful thing that this list, it's a muddied list.
Yeah. It's a muddy, and it's political. It's the way we are nowadays.
It's shameful.
Yeah. I like Jerry Garcia's guitar playing a lot more than I did, as Rob would know in the past. I've come to understand it a little bit more. I wish, the only thing I wish for Jerry Garcia's personally is that there was a little bit more distortion. Because the Mark Knopfler thing, I love Mark Knopfler. And he did this, actually. Mark Knopfler would have distortion when it was needed. Jerry Garcia... especially towards the last 20 years of the Grateful Dead, that just mainly had a clean sound. And over and over all the time from like 1973 to like the end of the band. And I really felt that a little sting, which he used to do in the first 10 years of the band. He would, if the song needed some distortion and some sting, he would put into it. And he kind of went into that that boring, it's a 20-minute song, and I'm just going to play that, you know, his. I actually like his style a lot more than I did even 10 years ago. And the only thing I can actually not agree with is I think he could have varied his sounds more. And but there is no doubt that he's one of the greatest guitar players of all time. No doubt. Even if you don't like the Grateful Dead, which I kind of do in a way now. I'm not a deadhead in any way.
No.
I'm not a deadhead in any way, but I used to hate them, and now I don't, because I exposed myself to every album that they'd made, and I understood them a lot more. I understood why they did what they did. And so even as a fan, but not a deadhead, I understand it completely why people go gaga over his solos. So definitely on the list, Brian May. See, we're getting into where we have to talk about everybody. But yeah. Brian May again. I have never been. I know he's made that homemade guitar.
He's got that layered sound.
And he's got the layers, and I don't like that. We talked about this before. I think we talked about this with Boston, with Tom Scholz, and his, you know, overdubbing the guitar four times for recordings. And Brian May does that. I've never been a fan of his homemade guitar. I know that that's the sound of Queen, but that's actually the thing that has drawn me away from Queen. It's just a personal preference, and I kind of can't talk about him as a guitarist too much because I just don't like his guitar sound. And
not a fan.
Just not a fan, but I'm a fan of his playing.
I'm a fan, but you're not.
I'm a fan of his playing, but when I hear a Queen song, I hear that guitar sound, and I kind of go, it just rubs me the wrong way. And I know I'm definitely in the minority here, but it has since I was a kid.
Right.
It has since I first heard Queen. But there, I have no objections with people saying he's one of the greatest guitar players of all time, because I can hear it. I can hear that. He's not great. Stupid.
Plus, like I say, he's he made that layered technique, something other people did.
And it's funny, because it's one of the one things that I just can't stand, is layered guitar sounds. Just can't stand. I think we're going to end it on. We only got into. Well, we got into 20. We got from 50 to 30. At number 31, one of my favorite guitar players of all time. And of course, this is not because of flashing guitar, but because he could come up with anything at any time, and he had to, because John and Paul said we need a guitar solo. George Harrison, who is an incredible human being, let alone, you know, it took me so long. I think everybody, especially in our time that we grew up in, when the Beatles were huge, but still not like today, they're actually bigger today than they were when they were the Beatles and together, which is hard to believe, but they are. The Beatles are now almost mythic.
Well, yeah.
They're almost bigger than life. And when I started listening to the Beatles, the White Album, people who have followed this show know that it changed my life and made me want to do this as forever.
It changed Charles Manson's life, too.
Yeah, well. I didn't appreciate it because I think everybody around that time was always so concentrated on John and Paul.
Yeah.
And their songwriting, and if they're going to get back together. And it took a long time for the world to come around. Actually, it took about time he released Cloud Nine, his album in 86. And then when he got sick, and then when he was gone, everybody was said, man, he was one of the best ever. And it was like, wow, poor guy.
Yeah,
like,
we should have told him that when he was alive.
We should have told him when seriously. Sick. We should have. Yeah, you know what? That's the world's fault. I got a great George Harrison story, which I don't have time to say it now, but I've been wanting to say it for a couple of episodes. It's something that I read in something that I saw in a magazine from Martin Short's biography that he wrote. And it is not only one of the funniest stories I ever heard, but it's very touching. About how he met George Harrison. And I want to tell that story, but I want to get it verbatim that I read it in. So I'm trying to find it. And I will tell it after our Christmas episode sometime. But if you listen to every Beatles song, which everybody in the world, I think, has almost listened to every Beatles song now, if you know what I mean, like, not saying everybody in the world, but so many people, more than any other artist, people have heard every Beatles song, if you know what I mean, their catalog.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You can go through every song and you go, wow, that's a good part. That's a good part. That's a good guitar part. Oh, this song, that's a good, like every song. Or that's a great solo. His solos are so underrated because they're so melodic and you can't get them out of your head, but they're also not grandstanding. So you don't go, I was blown away by that, but actually you were subtly blown away by it. And there is no doubt in my mind that 31 is at least appropriate, but maybe even higher, maybe even in the top 20. George Harrison was, I love guitar players that can come up with a riff that helps the song become better. Anybody literally can solo during the beginning of a song or in the middle of the song or at the end when it fades out and decorate it. But can you make the song better? And can you make a Lennon and McCartney song better?
Well,
yeah, actually, if you're George Harrison, you can.
All musicians, that certainly is our intention to make a song better.
We all intend to do that. George Harrison is one of the only people who can actually take some of the greatest songs ever written already and make them a little bit better. How big of a compliment is that? Really?
And doing it pretty casually, too.
And doing it pretty casually and just saying, sure, and telling people, no, I'm not a good guitar player. I just play fills. Fuck you, George. You're one of the best. We will, after the new year, tackle the top 30. That's the interesting thing about lists. It's the great thing is that it reintroduces you to artists and you talk about them. The numbering of them is the only thing that we have.
This guy's better than this guy. Let's fight.
Let's fight. No, seriously, you do get people really mad. You get people really mad. And it's like, it's unnecessary.
Because it lets you know their passion.
Yes. And if you're, because there are some people who go, oh, whatever. And that's the kind of what, see, you couldn't do this in 1978 because people were freaking passionate about music when I started. You know, we talked about this before, Rob, how you were judged a lot on the bands you listened to at the time. And you were like, oh, he likes that. That's bullshit. I don't really want to talk to that guy. At school, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
I remember they're buying records and hiding them from people.
Yeah. And then there's records that you didn't want them to know about. And now they all kind of listen to the same thing. And I like that. And I like that. And it's important to them, but it's not like getting beat up after school. Like it used to. I know that people are usually around our age that listen to the show.
It was clicky.
Yes, it was clicky.
It all falls down to the mods on the rockers.
It was clicky. And
you seen the movie Quadrophenia, the mods and the rockers.
Very much. That was based a lot on rock and roll. That was based a lot on music. The rockers, like the 50s rock and roll, and it had to do with fashion too, but the mods
like
loved
the 60s,
the Kinks.
And they thought
and
that
the
old rock and roll was dead and gone.
Yeah, they thought that was like Bing Crosby or something.
When I joined that one band there, the Idiots, they were all younger than me, and most of the music I enjoyed from like the 60s and 70s, they thought was, I think they described it as cheese. And then after about 5 or 10 years, they're like, fuck, this is a great album. Wow, this album is really good. Well, it's not like I lost respect for them.
It was important, though, like, and it still is to us people who grew up in that time when music was so important. It was part of how people judged you, and it was a part of everything. And you kind of carry that with you. You kind of never lose that, even though the times have changed. You never really lose that. But I've grown up, I used to be very pompous, especially when we started our band. I was like, if you didn't like this, like I liked it, you're bullshit. You know what? And now I'm like I am today, which I think everything is valid. Because if it makes you happy and makes your life a little bit better, then why knock it? It's just that I like this and this person may like that. my opinion isn't better than his. It's just that that's what I like, and that's what makes me happy. So I had to learn that. Sometimes that's just youth. That's just the cockiness and
of exactly youth. Youth. It's inexperience. Yeah. It's you haven't heard enough music to know,
and you think you're a big shot by saying to somebody your music's bullshit. My music, you should listen to. You should listen to the Velvet Underground. That crap your pop you're listening to is such bullshit. And you know what? I was totally wrong.
Look at this list of good bands. See how mine is ranked higher than yours?
Exactly. That's the epitome of pompous. And that's for a while how I was. And I'm not happy that I was like that. But you go through that. You have to go through that.
Live and learn.
Yeah.
You're not the same person you used to be.
Well, in a way I am, because I still think you're an idiot. But you're a lovely idiot. You're lovely about it.
Well, I don't know if everyone agrees on that.
You're an enjoyable idiot.
You're not a troublemaking, house-burning idiot. Oh, so far.
You know what I didn't do? Oh, I didn't do an introduction.
You didn't do an introduction to the album.
Wow, that's the first time I've ever forgotten to do that.
We got distracted.
Wow, no, well, we didn't get to, I got distracted, I guess. Or I just forgot when I was writing the script last night. I never do that.
Oh, by the way, we're reviewing an album.
I just want to say this is our 195th show.
I got 194 here.
This is our 194th show. This is the first time I've ever done that. So it's our first time for everything. We are reviewing today the Jimmy Buffett. See, I got that buffet thing in my head now. The Jimmy Buffett album, Down to Earth, released in 1970. Jimmy, unfortunately, passed away in early September from cancer. And this, I have to explain why I picked this album. Because this is an album that would be on many people's, if you're a Parrot Head especially. Parrot Heads are Jimmy Buffett fans. Dedicated Jimmy, just like the Deadheads. In fact, that's why they were called... You want to know the story about why they were called the Parrot Heads? Do you want to know the story? Or do you know the story?
I don't know the story.
Okay, there was Timothy B. Schmidt of Poco and the Eagles was playing with Jimmy Buffett, I think I don't know if it was the middle 80s or the middle 90s. I heard this story. It's not like I heard this story 20 years ago. I just heard this since he died. And he was playing on stage with Jimmy Buffett. I don't know if it was just as a one-off gig, just playing with him in front of an audience, or if he was touring with him for a while. But anyways, he saw all these people, you know, dressed in these Hawaiian-type shirts, you know, like that Jimmy Buffett wears, and they would follow him around to all these concerts, and Timothy B. Schmidt would see the same people at all these concerts that they were doing, and he said, "Oh my God, Jimmy, these people, they're like Deadheads. You could call them Parrot Heads because, of course, you know, the Hawaiian type of...
The colorful
coastal type of thing.
Tourist clothing.
And that just stuck. And so the people who follow the Dead, like the Deadheads, when they follow Jimmy Buffett, are called the Parrot Heads. I never actually knew until like a month ago why they were called Parrot Heads until I read that story in one of his obituaries. And I thought, yeah, okay, I'm glad I finally knew. Sometimes the hoopla, or just like with the Grateful Dead, or the fans, or the myth, sometimes overtakes the music with an artist. And Jimmy Buffett, I think, has always been overshadowed by the mythology of him as this guy on the beach writing these tropical songs. Without a care in the world with his guitar. Just like you see on some of his album covers, and you just see him and you think, and then you think of all his rabid fans and how they go to every show, and how he plays this... you know, coastal Florida type country rock, and how great it is. But I just felt that I just feel that somehow with some artists that their music gets lost in all the hoopla And I really feel that with Jimmy Buffett because I actually like him a lot. I know a lot of people do. But you know what? A lot of people say, I like Jimmy Buffett, but I only know like Margaritaville. But I like him because I see him. I saw him on TV and
puts
he was...
puts off a good vibe.
Yes, exactly. He puts off a good vibe. I went to go see him in concert. I didn't know any song except like Cheeseburger in Paradise and Margaritaville. But it was so much fun and everybody was so friendly. And yet they didn't really get the music. You know, they just got the good times. And yet he was very talented. And we had the question last show because I did not know he was a billionaire until he died.
Oh, that's right.
Rob asked me, well, how did he become a billionaire? Well, it all has to do with investments. And what he did was everything with his coastal music, going with a Key West influenced hotels and even old age homes and restaurants. And he made all those, like, and then he would call them Margaritaville. And I guess just real estate, just investing in his own name and in his own song titles. And with all his very wise businessman, that's how he became a billionaire by the end of his life.
That, I know some of the things he did worked and others didn't, but enough work that, wow.
Yeah. So, good businessman. Plus, he always played. Always played. He was like the Grateful Dead. So many similarities with the Grateful Dead. Always played. If he had an album, didn't really matter if he had an album. He was playing every year. He was going out there and playing stadiums. The kind of guy who sold out like the Grateful Dead every time he played.
Every time he played.
Every time. And still.
Oh, how nice it is to have a cult audience.
I know, isn't it? Like, wow. You're in your 70s and you can still sell out these huge places because of all this stuff around you.
People have grown to love you over the years.
People who love you and just can't get enough of your music. And yet I still think his music is underrated. I still think in the large cultural sense that people still say, I only know three songs, but I love Jimmy Buffett. You ever see him on TV? What a great vibe.
I hope he does one of those three songs I know.
That's the reason I picked this album, because this is before this album, Down to Earth, his studio album. This is before he incorporated the Key West type of sound and the themes that he would sing about. This is when he was in Nashville as I touched the mic, as a struggling songwriter, and he was playing folk music, and his first two albums were very un-Jimmy Buffett-like later on. They were very topical. They were very angry at some points. They were still funny in some points, too, but in a more biting way.
Yeah, topically it seems more like a kind of folk rock.
He's a singer-songwriter at this
protest.
Point.
Protest. Yes. Not protest. Yeah, not, protest.
Yeah, protest. Yeah, I agree. And so I was going to talk about the early, but I'll just say he went to Nashville in 1970, and then he wanted to, of course, make it as a singer-songwriter like everybody else. And what happened was he worked for Billboard while he was in Nashville, and he was one of the, I lost it now, I'm trying to find it. It's a very important thing that I wanted to say. Oh, he was one of the first people, as he was recording, and not recording, as he was reporting for Billboard, he was one of the first people to report that the bluegrass duo Flat and Scruggs had disbanded. I mean, he could have gone into music writing, I guess, if he wanted to, but he didn't. He was a singer-songwriter. That's what he wanted to do. He kind of wanted to go into the country music part of it. This is a folk album.
I hear country on this album.
Yeah.
Especially some of the songs he sings, a few of them, he really has an old-time country voice.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to get
others,
to that.
Others, he doesn't.
No, this is totally different. And that's why I picked it. We will do a Jimmy Buffett album that's in his wheelhouse later on. There's a reason I picked this, and the reason I picked it is because I wanted to show the artistry of Jimmy Buffett before he became the caricature. A good caricature, but a caricature. And I still love his stuff that he did, like Margaritaville, still one of my favorite songs ever, and all that stuff. But I wanted to show that he didn't start like that. And I'll tell you right now why he didn't. He released this album in Nashville. He lived in Nashville. He was signed on a contract with Barnaby Records.
Barnaby Records. I've never heard of them.
Owned by Andy Williams, which is probably why you never heard of it. he released, of course, this his first album in 1970, Down to Earth, in August 1970. Now, the thing about this record, and I read this in 1979 when I read the cover story on Jimmy Buffett and Rolling Stone, and I couldn't believe it at the time. It's taken me like, I don't know if I still believe it, but it's true. This album sold 324 copies. 300. And I remember I read that in Rolling Stone in 1979. They had a big cover story on him. And I said, this album must be terrible. This album to sell three. I've never heard of that before or since. 324 copies.
At the time, I think a gold record was 100,000 and a platinum was a million.
It's a million. So and if your album sold pewter. Like 50,000, it wasn't very good.
Grass.
If it sold like 50 or 5,000, it was like a total bomb. This sold 324 copies. I couldn't, like, it was stunning to me when I read that. And I was just, that must be the worst record ever.
Yeah, it's independent records, but record company records?
But it had to do with just being signed to Barnaby Records, which didn't know what they were doing and didn't do anything for him. Absolutely did nothing. Didn't.
Barnaby Records was an intention.
It was an intention.
They wanted to do something like a record company does, but they didn't know how.
Now, the funny thing also about this, and that's not funny to sell 324 records. I'm not saying that's funny, but it's
funny,
odd.
Peculiar.
It's funny, peculiar. Another peculiar thing is that, well, he wanted to do a second album. And then and he recorded it in 1971 in near Nashville in Tennessee. And he wanted to release it. It was a good record. I've heard this album also called High Cumberland Jubilee. And he handed it in to Barnaby Records. And they, this is just conjecture, but it's pretty solid proof by what you're standing on from the knowledge that, hey, this last record sold fucking 324 copies.
We don't want to deal with this guy
again. We signed him to a two-record deal. So we're kind of stuck legally. They told him that they lost the album because they didn't want to release it and lose money. I know that that's what happened. Jimmy Buffett knows that that's what happened. So they just said, sorry, we lost the masters. And, you know, you handed in your second album, so you've fulfilled your contract.
We
so you're
fulfilled
gone.
Our
exactly. Contract. So they let him go. They didn't release the album. And then when Jimmy Buffett signed to another record label and began his career as the Jimmy Buffett that he is now and became successful in 1973, not too much with his singles, but with his albums until Margaritaville came. In fact, 1 year before Margaritaville exploded onto the world, strangely enough, Barnaby Records found the masters. Oh, Jimmy Buffett's getting quite a name for himself out there. We found the masters and we're going to release them.
We're so sorry we lost them. I know you've never heard of this happening before. I've heard of Aerosmith leaving the first half of Toys in the Attic in the cab and losing them like that.
Yeah.
But,
I've never heard like you
not
actually
a record company losing stuff.
Taking to their office and saying, oh my God, did you hand it in really?
Gosh, we're boneheads.
What a bullshit move. And then finding it when you're big, all of it, because you're thinking, this guy's a dud. This guy's going no place. And then all of a sudden, he's selling records and they're going, oh, yeah, we found it. Yeah, we found it. Sorry.
See, right there, that says they have no discretion or judgment as to what good or bad music is.
Exactly. By the way,
just throwing
he was signed, by the way, after that to ABC Dunhill Records. That's where he made his... he was treated much better, let's just say. And that's where he started to make his name album by album. And also, just a little thing before we review the album is what changed him is that he was living in Nashville and going as a singer-songwriter with his first two albums. And in the fall of 1971, he went on vacation with Jerry Jeff Walker, famous for Mr. Bojangles. He wrote that. They went on vacation in Florida. He loved it in Key West. Just loved it down there. Moved his operations there in 1972. And from then on, his music took on that Florida kind of Key West type of sound.
Found a place he loved. Place
that, as you relax. Say, as you say so eloquently, that guy on the beach with his guitar. That's what he became from then on. So I didn't want to showcase that because I wanted to showcase that later on. What I wanted to showcase was, like, people loved Jimmy Buffett. And by people, I mean musicians. Bob Dylan has recorded one of his songs or did one of his songs in concert. And people don't realize, like, how good he was.
He did a duet with Frank Sinatra on his last album.
Yeah. Like, and people think of him as that, that guy that has all those hotels and has all those real estate things. And he has $1 billion and has all those Parrothead fans. And they forget about the music and how great a songwriter he was. So I pick this. I pick the album that sold 324 copies. And I've heard this album. And this is why I didn't just pick it. I have heard this album before I picked it. And I said, people got to hear this album. Or at least they have to know about it. So that's why we're doing it. It's not the end all Jimmy Buffett we're going to do. I think that doesn't do his memory service if we just spotlighted this album and didn't do one of his Margaritaville type albums later on, which we will. I'm a big fan of that too.
I haven't heard anything other than Margaritaville until this week.
Yeah, well, I don't know what that means. I kind of grew up. I actually started listening to Jimmy Buffett almost the same time. Well, the same time Margaritaville came out, which was huge single, was exactly the same time I started listening to the music all the time. So just as Jimmy Buffett became huge, so was my interest in music. And in the late 70s, he was big. He had Son of a Sailor, which is a great album, and other things. Anyways, always been a big fan. Even at that time, That image was taking over from him, you know, that kind of laid back, I'm a good guy, like that Sammy Hagar type thing. Hey, I like the party type thing. Yeah,
Sammy Hagar, you associate him with partying.
Yeah, and you forget about the music. And that's why I picked this album. I love this album. I really do. This album surprised me. Like I said, when I was a kid and I read Rolling Stone, I thought, wow, this had to be one of the worst albums ever to sell that few copies. It's very social conscious. It rails against quite a few things, but he writes really melodic and he writes really catchy, even though he's making a statement a lot of the times. And a lot of people are thinking Jimmy Buffett's making statements throughout the whole album. He is. He's kind of like, I would rather listen to this than listen to James Taylor anytime. James Taylor puts me to sleep. And he doesn't talk about anything but himself. I rather listen to this type of singer-songwriter that's
got something to say.
Got something to say. And he sure has a lot to say in this album. And I agree with...
First comment. Here's a cat who has something to say.
He does. He has something. He is not that guy on the beach right now.
He's not writing songs just to write songs. Right. He's writing songs based upon actual thoughts he has. And these songs definitely give me the impression there's a real thinking human being.
Yes.
With ideas.
But to write... like these types of topical songs and to be catchy is difficult. Very difficult.
It's catchy, and I'll explain why he caught me.
I'm gonna quickly do this before Rob does his review. Is that talk about some of the things that he talks about. I actually agree with what he's saying throughout this album. It starts off with the hypocritical Christian who I know, Rob. You know the person I was thinking of when I heard this song, the hypocritical Christian who thinks that what they're doing is right and everybody else is going to hell, and yet they're not doing. They would make Jesus very mad. Let's just say this Christian, and I totally knew about this song because we know people like that, Rob especially. I really did think about that person, which I can't name in case that person's listening. Yeah, somehow gets.
We know person. A person who fits the description of this song.
Yes, exactly, and it really hit home to me. I liked LSD because you know what. It's not LSD, it's an LSD. It's LSD.
LSD. The person. You go into a town, you meet a policeman. I'm looking for LSD. He's arresting you right away. I thought of that scene from the movie Hot Fuzz where he's a P.I. staker, piss taker. Oh, come on.
I'm looking for LSD.
I'm looking for LSD.
Do you know where I can get some? Is he over in the hotel?
You know where I can find LSD?
Again, you know what? The amazing thing about this song is it could be today.
Yeah.
It's the sad thing, it's a story about a black man who is not treated like the white people are, and he doesn't have the advantages of white people. And in the States, it's just unfortunately 50 years plus later, this song resonates just as much as it did in 1970. So it's very sad, but it's so true. Oh my God, it just rings so true. I like the missionary. It's a state again. These protest songs, and they're not even protest songs. I hate this and I hate this. It's just a Jimmy Buffett has a subtle way of saying thoughtful. Yeah, it's thoughtful.
The third song, the missionary. I wrote down the one line when I heard this. I laughed out loud.
I think I know which one it is because I did too.
I told them how we learned to change our sword blades into plows. I told them they should learn from us. What should I tell them now? And it's about a missionary who comes back and finds out the country he came from has gone to war.
Yeah.
And the
things that he had taught them, this country, this peaceful country, that he has been a missionary
tell us
for.
You know, look how good they
this is how we do it in America. In America, we just... We cooperate and we do this.
Well,
and then,
in the country he's from, we don't know where he's from.
Yeah, I kind of.
He could be European.
I kind of. Yeah, okay.
But he's not from one of the poor.
Let's just say what I took it from, and you can say because you're right. No, you're right, Rob. But I took it as a anti-American statement of listen, we're supposed to teach you people, and this is what I'm here to do in a peaceful way, and yet then their country comes in like Vietnam. And blows the shit out of everything and says, yeah, that's not what we're supposed to do.
See, I viewed that as being inspiration for the song, but in my mind, the mental
okay,
picture...
Okay, I take it both ways.
The mental picture was it could have been anywhere from the...
I find it an anti-poor song. No, a pro-poor song. Like, leave the countries alone is what I'm saying. You leave the countries alone. It's people who think that they know better than the country that they're at. That their country that they've gone to.
Well, especially when they very clearly don't. I mean, that one paragraph I read you, this guy tells all these people, we've learned to live in peace, goes back, finds the war. And now he's saying, geez, now I look like a chump. I look like a bald-faced hypocrite.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we got the exact same message. We're just looking at it from different points of view. Yep. It reminded me of something that hadn't happened yet when this song was written. It really stuck with me was the... takeover of Chile, the coup d'etat in Chile in 1973, when the missionaries and are going, you have a democracy, even though you've elected a communist, you have a democracy, he was voted in fairly, the American government, and you have a perfectly beautiful country, isn't this great? And then the Americans come and say, no, that because we make more money if we have a dictatorship. So they
a
instigated.
Few people made more money if they had a dictatorship.
Yes, and that this song reminded me of that is that the good people are saying the good things about America, and yet the government, the evil people, are
running
have
rings.
A total. I just say, you know what, your country's shit, and we're going to make it better because we're America. You know, and these poor missionaries are stuck going, you know what I just said? Forget all about it. My country's crap.
Yeah, I can see that, you know, at the time. And Jimmy Buffett is American, therefore he can do that.
And look how this song, written 50 plus years ago, makes us talk now.
Yes.
You know, and that's great work. That's great artistry to me.
The fact that it actually pulled out an emotion which made me do something.
Yes.
Laugh.
Yes, exactly. There are a couple funny lines in a lot of songs.
The last song I...
that was a good one.
I'll tell you what the hook is for that
one. There is actually quite a few lines in these songs. Some of them are very good. I like The Captain and the Kid. I liked all these songs, but I'm just going to... The Captain and the Kid because...
Denver.
I love The Mile High. See, I just said I liked all the songs, so I can't just go... But I do, because I like Mile High in Denver. It's like finding a place of your own... And saying, this is mine. And it's a very nice message. I like The Captain and the Kid. It's kind of understanding your father after maybe not understanding him for so many years. Yes. And saying, oh, yeah, this is what he did.
Especially
and I
after reading that his grandfather was a steamship captain and his father was a sailor. And in that third verse, when he mentions he passed away,
that's a very, very.
Once again, I actually felt something.
I did
teared up.
I did feel a lot when I and you know what I was thinking, how could this sell? This is at the point halfway through the album I'm going, how could this sell 324 copies? This song alone, Captain the Kid, should have
bolted this album. Yeah, because he did this. Isn't this one of the greatest hits albums?
It is. Would he I forgot to mention that, and I'm glad that you brought that up. In his first two albums, which didn't sell Budka, in fact, one wasn't released until 1976. He redid a lot of those songs later on his when he was a big star. And it shows that he thought these were good songs. It's just that if nobody knows it's out there, how do you buy it? And that's what his record company did.
Exactly. This exactly reminds me of Townes Van Zandt. Such a great album and being ignored.
I never thought about that, but just when you mentioned it, I said this is a Townes Van Zandt album. It really
that
is.
That story, yeah.
And we're putting Jimmy Buffett in that category, and I agree with that. And anybody who doesn't, then you haven't heard this album.
I'm glad he persisted. He didn't back off and say, this is hard, I'm not going to do it. I'm glad he kept going.
I am too. I'm glad with everything he did, but I'm glad he started like this. I'm glad people know how he was, you know, at the beginning. He wasn't just a guy, like we say, the guy on the beach.
Yeah, you know. He went through a bunch of different phases finding his musicality.
I just want to talk about these songs real quick at the end. I like Captain America. It's a throwaway, but it's still a good song. Ain't He a Genius? I love every word of that song.
Lyrics, yeah.
The lyrics are brilliant of that song.
Fighting lyrics.
Turnabout, which is actually kind of the same song as we reviewed with Tom Waits and Martha about meeting up with somebody.
That you haven't seen
in a while. An old flame. And the twist on this song is that he lets her go, but then as soon as she flies away, he goes, fuck that. It's impossible. It seems impossible to make this work, but I'm hopping that plane. Yeah, I'm going after her. And I love that. I also love There's Nothing Soft, which is true. Just the title alone. There is nothing soft or romantic or funny about Hard Times. And that's the song I like.
That's when I put two check marks on. It's a song I really, really liked. It was the one that really stood on the album.
I think for me, this and Truck Stop Salvation were the two songs that really hit me hard.
All these make it lyrically, but some of them make it musically more than the others. And this one musically and lyrically.
Yes, I agree. I agree with that 100%. I think because I thought Ain't He a Genius also was very good musically because it had that tag at the end.
Oh no! I just turned about. I got to talk about it a bit.
Okay, but I just really love this. This is, as Rob said, and he's 100% correct. Amazing lyrics about people having this preoccupation with romanticizing hard times, coupled with great music and catchy music, and saying there ain't nothing romantic about hard times.
There ain't nothing soft about.
I just loved it. I just thought, why did this album sell 324 copies? I Can't Be Your Hero Today. I love that. Again, a great message. If he would have done this, he may not have made, I know he wouldn't have made $1 billion and he wouldn't have had an industry or anything like that. But I'm telling you, eventually
he was going to get,
he was going to get through. He'd be like a Jackson Browne or something like that, where he may not sell millions of copies, but he would have got his message through. But you know, we all change, and he changed when he went to Florida for his own good sake. So I'm glad we have something like this that he did. I can't be your hero. I just love that as, you know what, you want me to be what you want me to be. Fuck you. I ain't your hero. I ain't what you want me to be.
That's one of those ones where I really noticed the country voice.
And the country voice very much in his song. By the way, his next album, which I also liked, which was like this, but it was a little bit more country and the songs weren't as strong, but I still highly recommend it. Those first two albums show a side which, if you want to be a Jimmy Buffett parrothead, I think you should listen to these two albums before. I think you have to, because you to get the full picture of what he's like.
I only know him from this album. Therefore, in my mind, I've included all his other albums like this.
Yeah. It makes you want to listen to all the other albums, no matter what they're like. And of course, it ends with, I think, a real showstopper with Truck Stop Salvation. Again, a very 1970s song about... But it's more than just
it
a hippie
was.
Song.
It almost kind of reminds me of the Alice's Restaurant.
Yes.
That kind of a small town
but
feel.
But to kind of not put it in that way, we'll put it in a way of
It's not funny like...
we'll put it in a universal way. In that, let's not say it's a hippie. Let's just say it's somebody who's different, who goes into a small town. And because he's different, he gets treated, visually, or, I guess you'd have to be, right?
You'd
visually.
Have to be.
Because because he's not like everybody else in a town, he becomes sort of like this circus object where everybody comes and talks about and mulls around. And yet he's basically the reason that they dislike him, which you get from the song that they dislike him, is because... He's the one thing they're not. He's not tied to that town.
No,
he's free.
He's free.
He
That's
can
the
do what
thing
he wants.
They're jealous and angry about.
People may say that if they listen to that in 1970, they don't like him because he's a hippie or he's got long hair. That's not the point. The point is he has the freedom to wear his hair any length, wear the clothes he wants to wear. I'm thinking of Peter Fonda, right? He can drive out with his motorcycle.
Yeah, I was thinking that scene.
Yeah.
They're in the restaurant.
Right. And he's just free. He's free to do whatever he wants. And they have never seen this before. And this, again, really hit me.
It was it also is a threat to them. Because what if the kids see it and start to emulate
Change or something you don't know of is always a threat. You get a black person moving into your white neighborhood, could be the nicest person in the world, but you've never seen a black person before, and you think, wow, this is dangerous. Just because it's different. You know what I mean? Just because
Another example, sometimes, you know, I'll be playing with the neighbor's baby or that, and then I take my hat off, and they see me with the hat off, and they just start to cry.
Okay, it's like that.
It's like that.
It's like having no hair and taking your hat off. That's what this song is about.
The last song, which is this one, the first line of verse 2. Nothing this exciting since a fertilizer truck blew a front tire and landed in the creek.
I know, that's my favorite line on the album.
I knew right from that line I like this song.
That is actually a Jimmy Buffett line that would happen later on in his career. And I'm glad that we got to see the humor that he would have later on. And I love that line. It made me actually, and I don't do this much, laugh out loud when I heard it.
That's two times on this album I laughed out loud. And one song brought me to tears, and not in a bad way.
Not because why can't it end? Not that kind of way. I had that with Gary Wright. But anyways. So to finish up for me, I liked every song. I give it a strong 4 stars, which means I don't know why I'm not giving it 4.5, but I'm going to give it 4 stars. And I just can't believe that for 40 years, I thought this was, just because of what I read and how it only sold 324 copies, that this was one of the worst albums of all time. And it turns out to be one of the biggest surprises I've ever heard. And I love it.
Well, he had to start somewhere. And actually, he started earlier, but this was his first album. The only things I really differ on, some of the songs, I go down and put check marks beside all the songs I like.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only three here that I don't. LSD, I thought was good, but it missed the mark. It didn't hit me with the impact it should have. Captain America, like you said, it was a throwaway song.
Yeah, definitely.
It's kind of a... It is thoughtful, but... better songs.
It just like you said, it reminded me of a throwaway song. Mm. And on an unthrowaway type album, you know what? It's a song that kind of doesn't fit on an album like this for some reason. It just doesn't seem to fit.
Yeah, it's an oddball. I mean, you got to write different stuff and try
to... It's still not a bad song. It just doesn't... It just seems like in an album like this with so much cleverness to it, this was a little bit too not subtle like the other ones. It was just
I was trying to get the meaning on that one. And
you know what? It's just right out there. It's just about Captain America. There is no meaning on this. That's why you're looking for meaning, just like, and I'm not saying you, I mean people in general, like myself, are looking for meaning in all these songs because he's kind of hiding it in subtle ways. And in Captain America, he's not. It's just about Captain America. There is no message in that.
What if it's about how people like a fictional character, a fictional hero, more than real life heroes?
Sure, what the fuck.
And I Can't Be Your Hero Today was it was a bit weak for me. Other than that, all the other songs, definitely lyrically, and most of them musically, I really liked. The one thing I have to mention is in the song Turnabout, after the lines, it does that guitar riff, which exactly reminds me, bump, 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 bump.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
From a song from The Who, from Tommy.
Oh, yeah. From Tommy. Yeah, yeah. The main theme. Yeah. I got to bring
it's
up
something. It's not exactly the same, but it reminds
there
me.
There has got to be something strange going on when we do shows. Because there's something in this that, and it doesn't mean anything. It's not a critique or a...
it's simply an observation?
It's an observation. And it's something you rarely get to hear, and it's in that part that you're saying in Turnabout. I'm listening to it, and it didn't happen until I listened to it the last time last night, which was still was like the ninth time or whatever, because I can't get enough of this album. And it's something that if you're a musician, you understand and have recorded, and I heard it as clear as day. When he's singing... the verses in this song, you can hear for sure that the music and the guitar is turned down. And this is something that me and Rob know very intimately. Then when he stops singing, you put the mute on everything and you turn up the guitar.
Yeah.
I could hear the guitar really loud on those parts you're talking about. Then I could hear it being... taken down as the lyrics, as he started singing again. And
I wasn't listening that closely.
But I did hear it come loud, and I was going, why is it loud? And I didn't hear it the other eight times. Or I heard it, but I was entranced by the song.
Yeah, you're listening to other stuff in the song.
I noticed it quite clearly this last time, last night, and I'm going, well, it was almost a nostalgia thing going back. Yeah, I remember when we used to have that so often, because that's what you do when you record, except you do it more subtle. Yeah. So that you don't actually hear it with your ears. You just feel it with your mind or your soul.
I remember in the early days of the boards, before you had the flying faders, the mechanized ones. Sometimes I remember the fading out of a song, you know, like everyone put their fingers on a fader and all bring them down at the same time very slowly.
You know what? People may not know what we're talking about, but in the analog days, every band had to do this. Lowly bands like us and bands like the Rolling Stones, they all had to do this at some point. Everybody had to man the tracks and bring them down at the same time. And you had to use sometimes three hands when you only had two.
You got like 24, 48 tracks, and you got the same number of these slider buttons. So
You know, it occurred to me later, why didn't we just use a stick?
Yeah, there are better ways to it. But I do know, and I'm glad you brought that up, is that every band had to do it. No matter how big you were, the technology wasn't there
yet.
It wasn't. So every band had to do it.
Gary McDonald eventually got one of those boards with the mechanized ones.
Where they did it automatically.
Yeah, they had little servos driving the... And then when things went digital, you just didn't bother with it.
Yeah, I've seen like film of bands like the Stones and the Who riding the faders, as they say. And I go, we did that. And it just reminds you that, you know, with analog, that a lot of us, we were all the same. We were all doing the same thing. And I just heard that. Again, it's not a criticism. It's just an anecdote.
It's just an anecdote
about how... you know, it brings back the analog. They don't do that now because everything's the same level.
Yeah, when I'm adjusting the volume on this thing, I go to the button there and I press it, and then I move the cursor over and I just expand the volume.
Right. And of course, you know that when this happens, that it's and it's a little bit glaring in that you shouldn't hear it, but it reminds you that it's not a high-end production and it's by a... It's by Barnaby Records, that's nobody's heard of. And it just makes it a little bit more endearing in a way, because you realize this is not Capitol Records or anything. This is a guy making his first album, and they're just like us. They're doing things like that. They make mistakes like that where you shouldn't be able to hear it, but it should be there. And I don't know, it's just endearing. It's just reminds you of a totally, oh my God, it's so different nowadays. But I miss those days. They were much more, excuse the pun, but hands-on. And they were much more human. And what do you give this album? I know that there's a couple of songs that weren't as strong for you as other songs.
No, this is...
Come on, I'm very interested to know what you... Because we both really like this album,
I obviously. I gave this one a 4-star as well. I didn't go 4.5 or 5 like I say, there was some stuff that didn't connect with me. But
you know what, Rob?
Writing lyrically is just totally surprising for me.
I was shocked. Album is lyrically almost unbelievable.
And musically, it's really inventive in places, and it's still good in others.
Yeah. I think the only reason, because I was close to giving this 4.5, but I agree with you. I think this can't be anything more to me personally than 4 stars, is because, even though I liked a lot I Can't Be Your Hero Today, and I didn't even mention Captain America, to be honest with you, I talked about every song on this except that one, not because I disliked it, because I just thought it was improper for the album. It wasn't, we're talking about the same things actually. I just didn't, although I disagree with you with LSD, it really hit me just because I thought it was so resonated with today that it was like, maybe that was had too much of an influence on me. But I do agree, like, I Can't Be Your Hero Today was a little bit slighter. Like, there was one or two songs that were a little bit slighter than the other ones. And I think that's why I gave it 4, although I would be easily persuaded to give it 4.5.
Oh, it's a fun listen. It's a good listen.
It's a great tribute to the man. And that's why I picked it, because I have heard this album before I picked it, and I loved it. And I think... it is a great tribute to the man. And we will...
Songs, an album that actually gets physical reactions out of me.
Yeah, same with me. And you know what? It's rarely that I hear an album over and over again and I still love it and still want to play it. And this is one... Like I'd say, I take this album over so many singer-songwriters that I heard in the early 70s, you wouldn't believe it. And Jimmy Buffett will be sadly missed.
And we are glad he was here and on this earth, because...
Damn right. Just for this album alone. Just for this album alone, not only the other great music he's made. That's our show for today again. We hit about the same time as we usually do.
Yeah, there we go. That's our hour and 20-minute show.
We're glad to bring a little bit of South Florida to a cold and snowy winter. Remember next week, Christmas episode. So tune in. And you know what? If you don't tune in, you'll be unhip. Like our former producer, Uptown Mike. Because he was as unhip as you could be.
Terribly unhip.
So you don't want to be like him.
No, he's almost not in the picture.
Well, he isn't. That's why it's like he's almost not in the picture.
Well, we still mention him from time to time. So he's around the picture.
He's around us, but he's not with us, if you know what I mean. So, as always, everybody, take care and stay safe. Just
right or wrong.
Yes!
Jones?
Jones. I had to do some of my Shakespearean acting.